Hello, my name is Chris Clark, and I'd like to welcome you to the Virtual Trombonist Podcast.
So one of the cool things about having your own podcast is that you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. And although my podcast is called The Virtual Trombonist, I wanted to do a special Veterans Day episode. And I'm going to talk today about one man in particular who was happened to be my grandfather. And I was very blessed as a child, a young person, to essentially have three grandfathers in my life. And one of those men was my maternal grandfather, Perry Brown. Perry was a U.S. Marine in World War II, served in the Pacific Theater, made landings on Corregidor, Guam, and Guadalcanal. He served as a radioman. The second was my step-grandfather, whom my grandfather, mother married when I was five after my grandfather Perry passed away. And his name was Barney Jarvis. Barney was a naval officer and flight trainer in Texas during World War II. Very unique man, quite a character. And the third is my paternal grandfather, James Clark. And he was a musician and businessman in commerce for a number of years. Before the war, he went to the University of Michigan in the mid-1930s, and he was a clarinet player. He had grown up near commerce and essentially self-taught as a pianist and clarinet player. And he went to Michigan to enroll to be a clarinetist, and the first semester he was there, he auditioned for the infamous band director at Michigan, William Ravelli. And the story goes that he told me was that Ravelli told him he would never make it as a musician and that he should just give up and find something else to do with his life. As much as I hate to think that he underwent that experience, he did leave and came back to commerce, where he proceeded to start his own dance band called the Southern Gentlemen. And the Southern Gentlemen were very active in the North Texas area in the late 1930s. And he also started the public school band program in commerce. So he was really the guiding force behind bringing band in a band program to our public school system there. I'm going to talk a little bit about his World War II service today because I came across some unique things a few weeks ago. I was cleaning out my office and going through old tapes and everything I had, and I discovered an old interview tape I did. And I made this interview with my grandfather when I was, I believe, in the eighth grade. And it was for a history fair project I was doing in middle school. And I interviewed him about his experience at D-Day. He was a D-Day veteran. And the interview's not that long. It's only about 10 minutes long. And the sound quality's not fantastic, but it's great to hear a veteran talk in their own words about their experience. Before my grandmother passed away, she did something that, I hope that many people do for their children and grandchildren, in that they documented much of, or she documented much of my grandfather's service. And when I say documented, I mean, I have about 4 or 5 inches worth of photocopied papers and records. I have his entire military record, his combat reports from all the amphibious landings he made in World War II. Just an amazing amount of information. So I don't want to go through too much of that today, but I thought it'd be fun on Veterans Day to give you all, especially people who are maybe not that connected to the military or haven't spent time in the military, to hear some of the things that he experienced in his training and in his military career. And best of all, you get to hear them in his own words. I'm going to read from his D-Day combat report, and I will also play the interview for you at the end of the podcast. There are a lot of parallels with my grandfather's military career and my own military career. It's kind of some funny coincidences. The first of which is that when he trained in the Navy had a midshipman school in New York City. The midshipmen were housed on an old World War I era battleship called the USS Prairie State. The ship had been known as the Illinois during World War I, and it had been towed into the Hudson River and moored at 135th Street on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. This was, in fact, about 10 blocks from where I lived when I lived in New York City, and unbeknownst to me, I didn't learn this until years after I moved out of New York, but my grandfather lived at 135th Street and did a lot of his classroom training at Columbia University. So I like to think about us walking up and down many of the same streets. The building I lived in was certainly a turn-of-the-century 1900-era building in New York City, so I can only imagine that maybe he walked by the building that I lived in, you know, many years before. So it's kind of an interesting coincidence. He graduated midshipman school on October 28th, 1942. And from there, he reported to Norfolk, Virginia. And he didn't report to a naval commander. He reported to an Army general commanding the U.S. Army's 45th Infantry Division. And he was attached to the 45th as a naval gunfire liaison officer. And naval gunfire liaison officers generally landed with the infantry of the Army, and they would call in gunfire from naval ships offshore. So he trained there and landed on, they practiced their landings on beaches in the eastern shore of Virginia. There's a little peninsula that's part of Virginia, just across the bay from Norfolk. And they would leave Norfolk in their ships and practice their landings on these deserted beaches on a very unpopulated part of the state. The 45th crossed the Atlantic and proceeded to make amphibious landings in both North Africa and Sicily. And it's about this time that my grandfather got attached to a Navy admiral named John Leslie Hall. And Admiral Hall was one of the proponents and early masterminds of naval amphibious landings. And the landings in North Africa and Sicily were a prelude to what the Navy and the Army would do in Normandy about a year later. And reading his combat reports from North Africa and from Sicily, you see a lot of things that the Navy did and that the Army did that worked very well in North Africa and Sicily, in that they did the same things in Normandy that they didn't work, such as pre-bombardment of the beach area that was very effective in Sicily. And in D-Day, it was in Normandy, it was almost completely ineffective. So it's interesting to read those reports and see what they learned and what worked for them that they tried to do again and that didn't work later on. My grandfather never talked about his decorations, as many veterans, you know, tend not to want to talk about their achievements during combat. But he had earned not only one, but two Silver Stars during his service. And the first of his Silver Stars was earned in Sicily. And a brief part of the citation I can read to you said, quote, "While in command of a surefire control party of the 45th Division, United States Army, Lieutenant J.G. Clark," that is Lieutenant Junior Grade Clark, "landed with the initial assault waves and courageously maintained position in the front lines, despite determined enemy opposition. Directing the gunfire of a supporting cruiser against hostile defenses with devastating accuracy, he contributed materially to the surrender of the town of St. Croix, Camarina," end quote. So that was in Sicily. After Sicily, they headed to Scotland, where they were billeted at a castle called Roseneath near Glasgow. And here, this is where they readied for Operation Neptune, which was the code name of what we know as D-Day. And D-Day was, as you know, an amazing undertaking. My grandfather landed with the Army's U.S. Army's 29th Infantry Division, the blue and the gray. And part of that 29th Infantry Division was the storied Stonewall Brigade of the Virginia National Guard. That was the 116th Regimental Combat Team. And the 116th was an army in itself. It was comprised of over 11,000 men that were readied for the landing at Normandy. And naval gunfire liaison officers, as I said, landed with the infantry. And my grandfather landed on Omaha Beach at H-hour plus 25 minutes in the third assault wave. I would like to read from his official combat after action report exactly what his experience on Omaha consisted of. From Lieutenant J.G. J.W. Clark to Commander 11th Amphibious Force. Subject: Report Operation Neptune, Shorefire Control Party. I was liaison officer with 3rd Field Artillery in support of 116th Infantry Regiment, Party No. 6. My men and equipment were a part of the Field Artillery Battalion. Equipment consisted of one SCR-609 channel of communications officer's radio to land at H plus 30, one SCR-608 to land with Headquarters Battalion at H plus 180, and one SCR-264 to land with a battalion gun, which were on call. The radio operators were from Headquarters Battalion, but had duties within their organization, as well as for me. I landed with third wave at H plus 25 on extreme left of Dog Red, our assigned beach. The beach was not clear, no obstructions had been removed, and it was apparent that the landing waves were not landed in the same beach area. The third wave was alone except for 4 DD tanks and a few engineers. We were receiving 88mm mortar, rocket, machine gun, and rifle fire from the time the ramp of the craft was open. This fire was very accurate. Many boat teams had to swim, causing complete confusion on the beach. The men froze on the sand, and we found it almost impossible to make them move forward. Many men lost their life because they would not move. All radio equipment in my boat was either lost or used for protection from small arms fire. I received superficial shrapnel wounds in my left cheek and hands. About 2 hours was spent working our way from the water to the top of the beach. There we found a trench and one dugout. We got as many men as possible into this trench and began collecting the wounded and placing them in the dugout. Upon checking our situation, we found about 60 men, one light mortar with 6 rounds of ammunition, and one bar along with small arms, one SCR-609 from the 3rd Field Artillery, and one SCR-300 from 2nd Battalion, 116th Infantry. The battalion commander, Major Bingham, Lieutenant Colonel Mullins of 3rd Field Artillery, and Colonel Thompson of 6th ESH, I'm not sure what that is, was with us. We found our situation rather hopeless with so few men and less firepower. The decision to await reinforcements was reached by Major Bingham, and we began to search out snipers and enemy overwatch positions. The slightest movement on our part brought enemy fire. I had no radio, and we could not contact anyone in 3rd Field Artillery that could relay for me. Before 1600, I took daring trips for a short ways up and down the beach in search of teams 4 and 5, but it was impossible to move very far. Taking advantage of waves coming in around 1600, I made a thorough search for the teams and found 4 men and an SCR 609 from Team 4, Lieutenant Lankwich's team. We set up the radio on the beach behind a DD tank and were able to contact the Glasgow. I asked for fire on the beach area behind Dog Red, but the Glasgow refused to fire, saying she was out of position and the target area was too close to our own troops. Enemy fire was very heavy and effective on the new waves landing, and something had to be done. About 1700, I was able to contact the USS Carmich and ask her to fire on our beach exit and cliffs. She also refused because the area was so very close to our own troops. However, I insisted that she fire, as every salvo from the 88mm was taking another boat or vehicle. She agreed to fire, and the first salvo I could not see because snipers made me stay under the tank. After 3 rounds, I took the radio and gave her the 3-story house on Dog Red as a base point and asked for direct fire on the area behind it. She fired an undetermined number of rounds. I then asked her to shift and fire again. She did so, and again I was unable to determine the number of rounds. However, this fire from the Carmich silenced the enemy fire, and the 88mm did not resume fire for the remainder of the time. Taking these 4 men and moving to Easy Green Beach, we found Captain Branson of Team 4 and later Lieutenant Lankwich. We moved to high ground near the beach and prepared to spend the night. Reports were that 2nd Battalion, 116th Infantry, was not functioning, and 3rd Field Artillery did not have a single gun. With this one SCR 609, I could contact some ships, but no shorefire control parties. By morning, men of 3rd Field Artillery had begun to collect with us, and I had sent Lieutenant Lankwich to the beach to pick up radio equipment, and by morning, we had 3 SCR 609s and 2 SCR 264 radio sets, all of which had to be reworked before they would function. So, there's much more of that combat report, but that gives you at least an idea of what the early part of the landing was like. I'm going to put up a page on my blog that goes with this podcast that will have a number of photos and links. I've got some great photos of my grandfather, of one of which was taken on Omaha Beach a couple of days after the initial landing. And then I also have, we have his original invasion maps of D-Day, and my uncle, Bobby Clark, took these maps a number of years ago and had some great color reproductions done that just look fantastic. They look like the original maps. So I'm going to put a picture of those also on there. And, on the photo of the map entitled Omaha Beach East, on the far right side of the map, there's a town called Les Moulins. And the Les Moulins draw was the main exit from Omaha Beach. So Dog Red was the sector of the beach directly in front of the Les Moulins draw. And the gunfire liaison officer's job was to clear that draw so that when the infantry landed on the beach, they could funnel up that draw on into Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer and the surrounding villages, Colleyville, Vireville, and many of those towns. So let's go ahead now to the interview, and after that, I have a few more things I'd like to read you.
Now, how many years were you in the service?
Almost 4 years.
Okay. Okay. And what was your job in the service? What did you do?
I landed with the Army and controlled the gunfire of the Navy guns in the landings until the Army could get their artillery ashore.
Okay. Okay, and how did you get to the beach? How did y'all land?
We landed in little 18-foot LCVPs. Landing craft vehicle personnel.
Okay, and how did the landing go once you got...
Went bad.
Okay. Well, what happened?
Well, we rendezvoused before daylight, and the coxswain of the small craft were inexperienced, and they would, some of them, get lost and land on the wrong beaches and so on.
Okay, and okay, you said you got, okay, and what recollections do you have of the invasion after you got on the beach? Just like what happened?
Of the Normandy invasion?
Yes.
Well, I landed on Omaha beaches with the 116th Regiment of the 29th Division. And we had a terrible time. In fact, I didn't get off the beach that first day. I spent the night on the beach. Just behind the beach, there were tall banks, and the enemy had dug holes through the hill, and they lay in those holes and directed mortar and artillery fire from behind them. And we just had a terrible time.
What kind of cover did you have on the beach? Was there like?
Didn't have anything. Just sandy beach. There were some trenches dug in places, but they were filled with soldiers. It's hard to get into one of them.
Okay, what were the results of the D-Day invasion pertaining to the war? What
were the results of the...
Yes, sir. Like, how did it help to end the war?
Well, the invasion of France was planned with no retreat. Vehicles from Scotland clear through England began to move when we left the beaches of England. And that began to pile up on the beaches in Normandy. But it was a one-way trip. We were either going to enter France there, or we were never going to enter it.
About how many soldiers did they bring in to the invasion?
Oh, gosh, Chris, I don't know. There was six divisions in the original assault of the beaches. That'd be 120,000 men, 140,000 men.
How many regiments were there?
Well, there's three regiments in a division, and normally two of them are activated and one is kept in reserve. So I guess there was probably 12 regiments hit the beach simultaneously.
And how many different beaches were there?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. There was the Omaha area was cut up into 10 or 12 beaches, and then the Utah area, which was further down the coast, was cut up into beaches the same way.
Where did you go after the invasion was over?
Where did I go after it was over?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I stayed with the 29th Division for 30 days. It took us 30 days to get out of gunfire range of the heavy cruisers and battleships. Then I was pulled back to England for rest and recreation.
And were you ever hurt during the invasion?
Yes, I got shrapnel in my hands and face the first afternoon of the landing.
What were they from? What was it from?
I have no idea.
Could you get it out, or?
Well, I went to an aid station the next morning, and they pulled the shrapnel out and dressed the places on me.
And you said, how long did you actually stay on the beach, did you say?
Until the second morning.
Second morning.
D-plus one.
And the Army landed in the morning, or?
Do what?
When did the Army get their artillery onto the beach?
I don't know. 4 or 5 days later, they had it pretty well ashore.
And after, how many years were you in the, how long were you in the service after the invasion was over? After
in Normandy?
Or after, just until you were, got out of the service?
I guess about 16 or 18 months. I went to the Philippines and then I went to Okinawa. That were supposed to land. But those teams got hurt and lost their radios and so on, and I got a radio that morning and fired the destroyer, hoping to hold up the troops. Gets technical because I had to report the activities of the other teams. Chris, they dumped us out in water about this deep. And my Jeep driver stood on the steering wheel and put his hands on the windshield and drove the Jeep out of the water. They were waterproof, and the exhaust come up, but we had a hard time getting ashore. Mm-hmm.
Did they have any? Did the Army bring like? Didn't they bring like tanks and stuff like that on the beach when they?
Our army.
What kind of guns did they bring with them? What kind of artillery?
Well, they brought the whole thing. They brought the Army division has. 105s, which is about a 4-inch gun, and a division has one group with each battalion, and then the division has like 6 or 8-inch guns, but they were some time getting them in. You see, those 104, those 4-inch guns can shoot about about 20,000, about a mile and a half. And then the 5-inch guns from the destroyers could shoot that far or a little farther. And then the 6-inch guns could shoot like 10 miles, and the 12-inch guns could shoot 20 miles, you know. But the first thing they brought in was mortars. Because they could carry them. Mm-hmm.
What kind of gun did you carry, just did the soldiers carry? Like?
I carried a 45 pistol and 2 hand grenades.
Did y'all carry like rifles or anything like that?
I didn't have a rifle. Enlisted men carried rifles. The officers carried pistols.
Well, this is really neat. Is this the stall you have up at the store that's in the frame? Is that what this was for?
That's the second one I got. I got one in Sicily first. And then after you get a Silver Star, they give you a Gold Star to go on it for a second one. Chris, the Silver Star is the fourth highest award you can get in the military. And it has to be in combat.
Is it like for leadership or?
No, it has to do with fighting the enemy. That's used to was shooting guns, killing people.
So, I hope that gives you kind of a little bit of a firsthand account of what many of our World War II veterans encountered. I'd like to read the citation for my grandfather's second Silver Star at Normandy. In the name of the President of the United States, it gives me great pleasure to award this Gold Star in lieu of a second Silver Star medal to Lieutenant Junior Grade James W. Clark, United States Naval Reserve. Citation. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity of action while serving as Naval Gunfire Liaison Officer with the 116th Regimental Combat Team during the assault on the coast of Normandy, France, June 6, 1944, and subsequent advance inland, June 6 through June 15, 1944. When the unit to which Lieutenant J.G. Clark was attached was virtually annihilated, and though wounded himself, he made daring trips along the beach in search of his three shorefire control parties and their equipment. Finally salvaging an abandoned radio, he successfully directed the withering fire of a United States destroyer against the enemy, neutralizing his weapons long enough for the American troops to occupy the commanding positions. He then reorganized the parties of his combat team and secured valuable naval fire support during the subsequent advance inland. His courage and initiative during an emergency and his leadership during the campaign were an inspiring example to his subordinates and reflect great credit upon himself and the United States Naval Service. Signed, Harold R. Stark, Admiral, U.S. Navy, Commander, U.S. Naval Forces in Europe. I'd like to thank everybody for listening today. This was a departure from what this podcast normally is meant to cover. However, it was a great connection for me, and it was great to find this old interview tape. Hopefully you will ignore my the sounds of myself at about age 12. It sounds pretty funny to me. Anyway, go to virtualtrombonist.com, check out the podcast page, and I will put a accompanying link under this podcast with a page with photos and the maps and some other cool things, and also photos of my grandfather Perry Brown and my step grandfather Barney Jarvis. So I hope you enjoyed the podcast today, and I hope that hearing that interview shows kind of might spur someone to interview or record memories of your relatives, friends, veterans that you know. Unfortunately, we don't do that near enough. And years later, you might want to know something more about your family history, and it's not there for you. So sit down with your iPhone, hit the voice recorder, and just talk to someone. And I don't think you'll ever be sorry that you have it. So thanks again for listening. You can go on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast, and go on my website at virtualtrombonist.com and subscribe to my email list. Happy Veterans Day. And if you see a veteran today, thank them for their service to our country. Thanks again. My name is Chris Clark, and I look forward to chatting with you another time.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend those lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody of my memory. I'm once again with you, and our love was new. Kiss an inspiration. Oh, but honey, that was long ago, and now my consolation lies in the stardust.